Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
WGN. It is the final episode of May here on Legal Face Off. WGN Radio, WGNRadio.com. Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini are here, the Legal Eagles. My name is Sam Panionovich, and Ben Anderson is across the glass. We've got plenty of topics to get to. Of course, legal grab bag at the end of the show. New rules with the ABA and Joe Sippert in here on many, many things that he's working on. But we begin with a conversation we had with Representative Ann Williams, who is from Illinois' 11th District. She represents the north side of Chicago. We're talking West Lakeview, Roscoe Village, and North Center, not to mention some parts of Lincoln Park, Lincoln Square, and Ravenswood. She joined Rich and Tina to have a conversation about a bill going on right now in Springfield on the Reproductive Health Act.
Representative, yesterday you and your colleagues in the Illinois House passed by a 65-40 vote the Reproductive Health Act. This act preserves reproductive health as a fundamental right. It, of course, comes in the wake of laws restricting access to abortions in many states, including Ohio, Kentucky, Georgia, etc. Why was it so important to pass this bill now?
Well, this you just laid it out. What has been happening throughout the country is an absolute deliberate attempt to overturn Roe versus Wade and restrict or, in some cases, ban women from access to safe and legal abortion. Here in Illinois, we had the right, makeup of the General Assembly to send a very clear message to those states and to Illinois women that we are not going to go back. We believe that abortion is something that should be accessible to all women, regardless of where they live.
Representative, many of these laws are so-called heartbeat laws, which ban abortion once a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which is as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy. How does this bill address that issue?
Our bill does one basic thing. It codifies all the laws on the books in Illinois into one clean, clear, comprehensive approach to reproductive health care. So it runs the gamut from maternal care to abortion to birth control. So none of us are doctors. We're politicians. We do not have any business weighing in on a family's decision on how to handle a situation late in the pregnancy where something goes terribly wrong. And we certainly don't have a right to tell women how to access health care. So what we're doing here is establishing an unequivocal foundational right to for women to control their bodies, their health care, and their lives.
Obviously, this has generated, I mean, this debate has obviously generated a lot of emotion. One of your colleagues gave a very impassioned discussion yesterday on the floor, against this bill. And in fact, you know, the votes lay down according to party lines. It's very timely, of course, because yesterday the U.S. Supreme Court refused to take up an Indiana abortion case. And its decision actually let both sides in many ways claim victory in the abortion debate. But I think what was interesting yesterday was that it signaled that the Supreme Court is not addressing the big issues now, but that it would soon. In fact, Clarence Thomas wrote, I'm going to quote him here, although the court declines to wade into these issues today, we cannot avoid them forever. Having created the constitutional right to an abortion, this court is duty-bound to address its scope. In that regard, it is easy to understand why the district court and the Seventh Circuit Court looked to Casey to resolve a question it did not address. Where else could they turn? The Constitution itself is silent on abortion. So we're all... It's pretty clear that we're headed to the Supreme Court on these issues. How soon do you think the court will take up these challenges to Roe and Casey? And do you have any sense of how they will rule given the current makeup of the court?
I don't know when that's going to happen, but we definitely felt and continue to feel a sense of urgency in Illinois. You know, our thought was rather than allowing the autonomy of women to hang in the balance, dependent on the political winds and the latest decision by the Supreme Court, we really wanted to establish an affirmative right for women in Illinois to access safe and legal abortion. And that's exactly what we did yesterday.
So the bill now heads to the Senate before it hits Governor Pritzker's desk. You certainly have the numbers. Do you think the bill is going to get signed into law?
I feel very confident that we're going to be able to move it out of the Senate. We were actually joined today by two state legislators from Georgia and one state legislator from Missouri who came here to Illinois to share their experiences with the passage of the terribly restrictive legislation in both of those states. They were here to, you know, urge us on with the fight to protect safe and legal abortion here in Illinois and just stand in solidarity with us. But they did tell their stories about what it's like in those states and how constituents are reacting and how women are really quite panicked. And it does feel extremely urgent, and it feels like something we, as a blue state, as a state that historically has valued women and women's rights and access to reproductive health care, it felt like the time to do this, and I feel very confident we'll be able to move it forward.
That is Representative Ann Williams, who is the 11th District Rep on Chicago's North Side. Representative, we know you're busy. We know things are flying left and right in Springfield. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off here on WGN, WGNRadio.com. Joining us now on the phones to talk about the new rules for the ABA. He's the executive director of the Law School Transparency, lawschooltransparency.com. His name is Kyle McEntee, and he joins us now on WGN. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, how's it going?
So, Kyle, a few days ago, the ABA Council of the Section of Legal Education and Admissions to the Bar, which accredits law schools, adopted a new rule which requires that for a law school to remain accredited, 3/4 of its students must pass the bar within 2 years of graduating, or the school will lose its accreditation status. This rule has met with a lot of objections and controversy. How much of an issue is failing the bar, and why has this new rule caused so many objections?
Well, for graduates, failing the bar is a really big deal. People go to law school in general to be lawyers, and in the United States, you cannot be a lawyer unless you have passed the bar exam. And as a result, law schools need to ensure that they actually prepare people so that they can pass the bar.
How is that?
To be held accountable.
Have the rates of passage decreased over the past few years? Like, do you have any statistics you can share with our listeners?
Yeah. So the average score on the MBE, which is the multiple choice part of the exam, given in 49 out of 50 states, that has declined almost every year. There's been a few blips here and there, but by and large, we've seen a steady downward trend, and it's related to the students that law schools are admitting. They're enrolling people who have lower credentials than they have in the past.
So what's the solution? Do you think that they should toughen their standards for law students? Should they make the exam easier? What should be done to remedy this issue?
So it's a variety of things that need to happen. One important thing is that the exam itself does not need to be easier. But in some states, such as California, the cut score, which is the minimum passing score, should be lower because it's unjustly high, and that's high for no good reason. In other cases, schools do need to raise their standards. They've been admitting people as long as they have a pulse, and they're doing so because they have great financial need to to get bodies in the seats. And then in other cases, schools just need to do a better job of ensuring that the people that they do admit and enroll are prepared to meet the rigors of the bar exam.
And what's the relationship between admitting students and actually becoming a solid practicing attorney? What are your thoughts on whether the standard by which we're testing and admitting students to law school, whether that's an effective way to measure where they'll be, whether they'll be, you know, good, solid members of the bar once they graduate?
Sure. So there is a statistically significant correlation between performance on the LSAT, which is the admissions test for law school, and performance on the bar exam. But that's a different question that I answered than the one you asked, which is becoming good, solid attorneys. Now, of course, to be an attorney, you have to pass that bar exam. But there's no apparent relationship between passing that bar exam and being a good attorney, other than it's a prerequisite for it. And that's because the bar exam, as it is today, is not, in scientific terms, a valid exam. The very reliable exam, which means that from year to year, we're getting this similar results and we can trust those results. But in terms of whether it's there's a relationship between the practice of law and what's needed to be a minimally competent lawyer and the bar exam, there's significant doubt there that that's what the bar exam is actually doing.
Has the bar exam changed at all? I mean, Rich and I have been doing this for a while, sometimes more years than we care to admit. To what extent has the bar exam evolved? I mean, we of course know that the practice of law has changed quite a bit. As you alluded to, the bar exam doesn't necessarily always provide a good indication as to what the likelihood is that a lawyer will succeed. How has the bar exam evolved, if at all, over the past few years?
So in a few ways, we've seen the subject matters tested evolve, and this is all on a state-by-state basis. Some states have increased the number of subjects that they test, and other states have reduced the number of subjects that they test. In terms of the standardized portions across states, we've seen the addition of civil procedure to the exam. And then we've also seen something called the Uniform Bar Exam, which is now adopted, I think, in 34, if not 35 jurisdictions. And that doesn't actually go to the substance of the exam, but how states relate to each other on who they admit to practice. But that was an important change from an advocacy perspective, because it will make it easier to push further changes down the line to the actual validity of the exam. In other words, make the exam reflect something more like what minimum competence actually is.
That's Kyle McEntee, Executive Director of the Law School Transparency, lawschooltransparency.com, and the new rules for the ABA. Kyle, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, compalliance.com.
You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, and also on iTunes, where you can always rate, review, and listen to the show. It's Legal Face-Off. Rich Lankoff, Tina Martini, and the studio is almost jammed. We have Joe Siprit, who's been here multiple times from Siprit PC, the founder and the managing partner. And we have Kim Brooks from Chicago Magazine. It's a party in here. Welcome. Welcome back, Joe. Welcome, Kim. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Here to observe the litigation finance out here, and Rich is very excited, I can tell.
Very excited. So, Joe, welcome back, repeat guest to our show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You have a lot going on. We've covered the many different things that Siprit's involved in, including not just your busy legal practice, but film, right?
Yes.
A burgeoning film career.
Yes, I've made it from the G list to the F list. I'm aspiring to one day get to the D list.
I want to hear about some of your film work in a second, but I want to talk also about your work with litigation finance, because this is a booming area, very hot topic in litigation, and you're at the forefront of it. Tell us what you're doing and why you're involved in that area right now.
Sure. Well, I'm the co-founder of a hedge fund called Kerberos Capital Management. That's K-E-R-B-E-R-O-S. By the way, quick trivia, our logo is a three-headed dog. which ties into the name Kerberos. Now, you might ask yourself, why would someone have a three-headed dog as a logo, besides the fact that, of course, it just looks kind of cool.
You own a three. You're the only human that actually owns a three-headed dog, I understand.
Correct. Well, you know what? We lost him a few months ago. Apparently, the lifespan for the three-headed dog is not long. But he had a good run.
So what's the genesis behind the logo?
So the three-headed dog logo is that in ancient Greek mythology, the beast that used to guard the gates of hell was a three-headed dog named Kerberos, or I think that's the Greek pronunciation. Latin is Cerberus. Apparently, there's already a hedge fund named Cerberus Capital Management.
Yes, there is.
So, in Chicago, by the way.
Yes.
So we went with the Greek version, which is Kerberos. So I'm the co-founder of the fund, and I'm the managing director of the fund. What we do is litigation finance. And the reason for the fund is that about the last 10 years have seen a life cycle, an incredible life cycle of this industry, where it went from being almost non-existent, you know, meaning like one or two funds in the entire United States that would actually do deals like this, to what it is now, which is a very sophisticated market that has already given birth to a secondary market and so on and so forth. And it's at the point now where about 50% of all lawyers have actually used litigation finance.
What does it mean, though? To our lay people listening, what is litigation financing? Mean?
Sure. Litigation finance, sort of generally stated, is using litigation assets as collateral in order to procure sort of independent third-party financing to either prosecute the claims or to borrow against the claims or whatever it may be.
So someone's got a personal injury lawsuit. Someone falls at a store. They file a lawsuit against the store. You represent them, or whoever represents them as an attorney. That is an asset, so to speak, because there is a proposed return down the road, which is maybe they'll get money through this lawsuit. They use that leverage as a means to get an advance towards an eventual settlement or verdict. Is that sort of what we're talking about?
Yeah, that's generally correct. It comes in a couple different shapes and sizes, though. So, for example, if you have a personal injury case where, you know, Bob Smith is suing defendant whatever because he broke a leg and there's a personal injury claim, there's a couple different ways the litigation finance equation could work. One is Bob Smith himself, the individual, seeks to procure money from some kind of fund that is interested in giving him X dollars, you know, based on the value of his claim or the damages that he can take today and take some money off the table, basically. Or maybe it's a loan on a recourse basis. Another way of doing it is that the attorney himself or herself seeks to borrow against the litigation asset because that attorney needs a cash flow solution or wants to invest and buy more cases. So what our fund does is the large stuff for attorneys on the higher end of the spectrum, meaning a small transaction for us would be probably $500,000. A typical one would be more like $5 million. So at that level, you've got typically portfolio financing. So a typical scenario would be a lawyer has a docket full of cases, mass torts, class actions, personal injury cases, commercial cases, combination of the above. The valuation of the portfolio on the whole is, let's make up a number and say $100 million. And he's not going to monetize any of his cases for probably a year, just based on the life cycle of those cases. So he's got a problem that he has to solve today. He can't go to a bank. Why? Because the banks don't know what they're looking at. They can't underwrite that collateral. They'll throw you out of there and look at you like you've got four heads or three heads, like my dog. Say, what is this?
Because they don't understand that. They still don't understand this kind of deal, right?
They don't get it. Traditional banks don't understand it. Regulations make it difficult for them to consider it, even if they could understand it. But you'll walk in there and say, so I've got $100 million worth of receivables, basically, right here. What can you do for me? And they'll say, very interesting. Okay, can I see your last 3 years of tax returns? And you say, no, you don't understand. You don't get it. It's nothing to do with that. And they say, oh, okay, I get it. So what was your revenue last year? No, you're still not getting it. That's the conversation you have with banks, right? So these funds have come into existence that basically can underwrite what is really good collateral in a way that can be quantified fairly well and still lend at high premium sort of mezzanine type rates because of the fact that traditional capital sources just aren't available. Meanwhile, that attorney who is the borrower here, he gets a solution to a very important problem because in the plaintiff side of things, and I know this from personal experience, cash flow management is a huge part of the game because these cases go on forever and it takes forever to get paid. And so you got to have some kind of mechanism in place. Litigation financing basically provides that mechanism. We can also talk about other variations where it's more like a joint venture model where you want to bring like a particular case and you sort of get a partner to fund the prosecution of the case. That's another offshoot of it.
So what type of cases do you think are the ones that really lend themselves? For example, I spoke to somebody who I know who's in this space a couple of weeks ago, and he's part of a fund also, and he said that they look at intellectual property cases a lot. For example, like particularly patent litigation cases. Are there certain types of cases that are really in the sweet spot of this type of offering?
Yeah, I think patent cases are a great example of this because the typical patent case will meet all of these elements. You'll have a situation where there's potentially very large damages. The claim may be very good, but there are significant costs, especially in the patent world where you need, you know, the experts, and it's very heavily discovery driven and based and so on. So you need a lot of money to prosecute the case. So that's the metrics are there for litigation financing to come in and say, okay, you know, we'll come in and say a fund says we'll provide you $1 million in a line to finance the cost of the case. And if we win, we want a return of whatever, you know, 8X or 6X or 12X, whatever it is in a particular case. To do that, though, you need volume because it's a venture capital model. So you need, if you're a funder, you need like, you know, 15 of those, not just one.
Right.
And you also can't be doing that in the patent space unless you actually understand the patent space, right? So that usually funds are specialized. And I suspect the guy you talk to, I mean, they probably do a lot of patent stuff and maybe not much else because it requires a lot of specialization.
Right.
And it's a great, you know, space to be in. Our fund is a little more broad-based. It's more just general commercial litigation, including, you know, mass torts, class actions, all this kind of stuff on the plaintiff side. And if we can use the whole portfolio as collateral, we can solve a lot of problems, which in turn makes we like to think the wheels of justice, you know, grind a little more efficiently.
So as a defense lawyer, I have to push back, right, and challenge you on a couple of things. Number one, does this drive up the amount of frivolous lawsuits? Does this incentivize people who would otherwise not have a necessarily meritorious claim to pursue it? Number two, is it predatory? Does it, you know, prey on plaintiffs who are vulnerable and who need money and then, you know, take a percentage of the outcome that they would not otherwise have to give up?
Yeah. So as is usually the case, when you disagree with me, I'll now proceed to demonstrate why you're wrong.
Uh-oh.
On each of those
specific points. Yeah.
So generally, let's start with this point. First, as a basic premise, to the extent that people have meritorious lawsuits and need a capital solution to bring those cases, people meaning either the plaintiffs themselves or the attorney himself who may not be able to take a case on contingency because of a lack of resources, to the extent claims that are otherwise meritorious are not able to be brought because of this problem, the fact that litigation financing might bridge that gap should be seen as objectively a good thing, not a bad thing. Now, as to the frivolous lawsuits part, I actually think it cuts exactly the opposite way. Because what happens with funds who are heavily incentivized and, you know, care very much for self-interested reasons about making good underwriting decisions, they don't want to be in the business of investing in bad lawsuits. Even if they didn't care about other factors, if they care about their own self-interest, that would be enough of a reason. So what tends to happen is that if a claim truly has no merit, if lenders are involved or funds are involved to look at underwriting that and doing a deal, and all of them say, no, we wouldn't touch this thing with a 10-foot pole, that means that case probably never gets brought. Because an attorney or even a plaintiff who's emotionally invested, if you're told the same thing enough times, i.e. your case sucks, then you're going to, you know, abandon your steam, your momentum, I think. So if anything, it probably leads to fewer meritless cases being brought. And then you had another point, too, that I forgot.
The predatory lending component of it?
Right. So our fund doesn't do any direct plaintiff deals. So the short answer is that we prefer to lend only to attorneys and law firms, in which sense it's more like a commercial transaction. We don't do direct plaintiff deals. And I think the predatory stuff that you're talking about is more where, like, you know, like in the NFL concussion litigation, you perhaps have heard some discussion in the courts there about some of the NFL guys had signed up with a lender who was lending them money at a very high interest rate on their future settlement cuts. And by the time the settlement money came due, you know, it was heavily diminished and the courts got interested in that. And that led to a lot of scrutiny of this issue. Short answer is we don't do any direct plaintiff deals because we don't want that problem. And I'm not saying, by the way, that any such deal like that is predatory. I mean, fundamentally, right, if you go to a subprime lender, you know, not a bank, but, you know, some fund outside the legal space, subprime lender of any kind, and you say, look, you know, I can't get money from a bank. I've got a higher risk situation here, but I want you to underwrite it because of whatever my pitch is. If they decide to do it, of course you expect to pay higher rates. Now, does that make it inherently predatory? No, I don't think so. It's just the way the world works, right?
All right. So let's tell our listeners a little. We teased this earlier, but in addition to this fund that's very interesting and your day job being, you know, one of the foremost class action attorneys, I think, in the country, you've got a lot of other things going on. I can relate because I have a couple of things going on, but Siprit is a producer, not the least of which films was an award-winning documentary about the Chicago Bears. You are a soon-to-be nightclub owner, and you own a couple other ventures. But the most interesting part is your burgeoning acting career. Not very common for an attorney to have his foot in acting. We've covered a couple of your films before on this show, but tell us what the latest Joe Siprit acting role is.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning it. So the last movie I was in came out in theaters last month, actually. It was called Crypto. Kurt Russell starred in it, along with some other folks. One of the Helmsworth brothers was in it. Some good names.
Wait, Kurt Russell, like the Kurt Russell, not
correct.
Kurt Russell with a C or something.
No, the Kurt Russell. Yeah, the one you know
Escape
and love.
From Alcatraz.
Nice.
Tombstone.
Tango and Cash.
Yeah. He starred in that
Snake
one.
Snake Plissken.
And I played, that's right, Escape from L.A., that's right. And I played the main villain in that movie.
Wow.
I played a murderous Russian gangster who had a very
everything except
agenda.
The Russian part is hard to believe with with Siprit.
Can you give us some? Can you give us the accent? Can you,
yeah.
You
know, something.
Give us a little preview.
You know what? It's most of my lines were delivered in non-accented
with a gun.
English, but I did
all
I,
action.
I did have one line in authentic like Russian dialect, which I absolutely nailed. But I cheated because it was in the studio.
I must break
and
you.
And I had the you know I had the thing there the lines in front of me. So yeah, so that's fun for that to happen every so often. I'll be in a movie and something comes out. You know, I just kind of fell into that, and I was in one or two originally for fun, and I started getting phone calls to appear in more stuff, and it turned out I had somewhat of a knack for it and liked it, and then took it seriously, you know, tried to really learn the craft. And so now I'm at a point where, you know, every so often I'll get pitched something, and, you know, hey, do you want to act in this? Do you want to do this? If it sounds like fun, and it seems like a good role, I'll say yes. If it's
and the name of the nightclub that's opening soon?
Christ, what do we call that?
Three-headed dog.
We think it's, that would be a good one. After, we believe what, it's the name.
Oh, after, that's right.
Imminently yeah. opening here in Chicago.
Yeah.
And nice. They will have vodka at the club.
Yes, exactly. Siprit is not only an owner, but he's the bodyguard. He's the bouncer, the Russian bouncer in the club.
That's right. You know, depending on what happens in a given evening, I could wear, you know, different hats. So we'll see. They may have to, you know, peel me off the floor the next morning with a shovel, but we'll see.
Do we get VIP passes?
I think for you, yeah.
Oh, thank you.
I'm thinking yes. Yeah.
I don't know about you, Rich.
No.
He's gave away our only VIP pass to Martini.
He's going to be in the back
of
the queue.
Not Sussler. Sussler has to wait in line like everyone else.
Yes, unfortunately. Sorry, David.
Joe Siprit from Siprit PC, the founder and managing partner who brought along Kim Brooks, Chicago Magazine. Thanks for coming in, both of you, and hope to see you again soon.
Thanks for having us.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
And it's Legal Grab Bag time on Legal Face Off, WGN, WGenerated.com. Rich and Tina and Sam, we're joined by John Walker.
It's hot in here, by the way. Is it warm?
Woodruff, Johnson & Evans.
It's because you ran all the way over here, Rich.
Man, I just got winded doing Casey Kasem.
You're telling bad jokes in front of comedian John Mulder.
Exactly.
How would you critique that joke?
I'd say it was good. Yeah. Good. He didn't do a Shaggy, so we're still settled. And the best part that I loved about it was at least he didn't do the... And now, Motley Crue's bastard.
Now that's
so
Casey
much
Kasem.
Better than you.
Oh
wow.
My God, much better.
So we've got seven
a battle
topics.
Of the Kasems today on Legal Face Off.
And Case Off, is this a Case Off?
Yes,
this is a Case Off. So the seventh topic you said you're just going to throw in at the end. So I guess we'll
as Casey Kasem.
All right, the first one involves
A.G. Vorty.
Public statement involving the president.
Mine's like much more of a drunk, like crazed Casey Kasem. By the way, if I told you once, I told you 100 times. Don't come out of a dub tempo song with a dead dog story.
First topic, go.
Okay, so Mueller, of course. Mueller is in the news. Mueller, at 11 o'clock, just had his only press conference since he's been appointed a special counsel. And, you know, we were all jacked up to hear what he said, and he really didn't give us much news beyond what he said in his report. The bottom line for his about 9-minute statement was, and he took no questions, by the way, his 9-minute statement, he said, again, we did not litigate the issues of whether Trump committed obstruction of justice. The only thing that we decided was whether the Russians were involved in interference with the election, and they were. He said that because they could not prosecute a sitting president, because the Department of Justice could not prosecute a sitting president for obstruction, which we all knew, he basically said there was no point in dealing with that. Now, again, he reiterated that if he would have decided, or if he would have found evidence that the president did not obstruct justice, he would have said so. That was really a key takeaway from the Mueller report. He reiterated that today, of course, giving a lot of life to people who think that what Mueller was signaling is that, hey, I'm not saying that he didn't obstruct justice. All I'm saying is that we can't prosecute him now. There is no venue now under the Constitution and DOJ rules to prosecute a sitting president. But that doesn't mean once he's out of office, you can prosecute him. So a lot of people are taking that to mean that there is evidence out there and you should pursue it once Trump leaves office. But today was sort of, you know, not a big surprise in my mind. He said, that's it. I'm resigning.
Right.
You'll basically never hear from me on this issue
again.
Yeah,
he's closing the special counsel's office and he's riding off into the sunset.
Right.
Adios, Mueller. We've really enjoyed you.
Yeah. What do you guys think? Disappointed with... Mueller, do you think he should have been more aggressive in pursuing obstruction charges against Trump? I mean, again, bottom line is the DOJ rules don't allow a sitting president to be prosecuted, but, you know, many who don't support Trump are disappointed with how Mueller's handled this whole affair.
Well, what I think he's saying is this is the job of the U.S. Congress. So the House of Representatives should bring articles of impeachment. And the trial is then held and the vote's held in the Senate. And the reason for this is you can't have, when you think about it logistically, and this was something that goes back to the Constitution, you can't have a trial with a sitting president on trial, a criminal trial. So there is a remedy, and it's the Congress of the United States who should take action if they believe that's appropriate.
By the way, now's a good time to remind our listeners that John Walker is Canadian, so taking constitutional lessons from a Canadian, as am I, so we think we're in a good position to discuss the Constitution.
I think you're in the best place, A, and B, you guys are fantastic.
That's right.
I really like it. I'm going to go grab a loon. I love Canada,
not,
by the way.
Not bad. Not bad. Canadian accent.
It's just like, so I was out and about, and there was a lot of friends, and we
what
were having
fun. What would Casey Kasem sound like if he was Canadian, I wonder?
Why do I think we're about to find out?
Or what would Shaggy sound like if he was from, like, Victoria or something?
Like, Zyke Scoop, excuse me.
There you go. I apologize.
Pounding a bottle of maple syrup.
I apologize. It's funny. You just touched on a good point. I think I think the recipe was already written. It was baked in the cake. There's no way you were going to get anything new, because it's like your boss saying, okay, I'm taking two things off the table legally that you can't even touch or do. So it limits your scope of what you can do. He knew that going in. So they kind of, you know, it's like your boss almost going, you can't do this and you can't do this and you can't do that and you can't do this. What do you got? And legally speaking, he knew that he wasn't going to be able to indict anybody. So that once that's taken off the table, there's no big guy riding on a horse. There's no Captain America coming in. But part of it that's odd is he laid out the groundwork and basically said, all right, here's the deal. I wasn't able to do this because by law I can't do this. Here's all the crimes and here's exactly how it happened. It's up to you. Finish on home. And I'm going to the Hamptons. Have a good one. And he's done.
Well, I think there's part of this that we're missing is that quite a few individuals, Americans and Russians, were indicted. Mm-hmm. And part of the Mueller investigation, you know, we really focus on Trump and that this term collusion, which is not a legal term. But what we were missing was the Russian interference and the concerted attack, which they did find. And they found, I mean, that was about half of the report was the Russian interference.
Trump seems really concerned about that, by the way. He seems really concerned about another Russian attack on our democracy, doesn't he? Not so much.
I don't know about that, but I think what Mueller did say, I think was the last thing he said before he left the podium, was that this should concern all Americans, that you have a foreign power. Now, whether that right now that's Russia, you know, we're seeing Chinese interference in other countries, but a foreign power intervening in an election is something that should give everybody pause, because it's happening all over the world. And this really appears to be the first time that's happened in the United States.
So Lori Lightfoot, the new mayor in Chicago, has taken a shot, I guess you could say, at the aldermen. She's trying to limit some power, which has been an issue for years, the mayor against the aldermen. And she went on WGCI last week, and I quote, "They want me to get shit done." That was the quote that the mayor said.
Are we allowed to say that
on
WGN?
Yes, you can read some political communication.
I was going to bleep that part out, Sammy.
Well, maybe Ben can add a little.
No. I like this. This shit's good.
Oh, damn right.
There we go. So, Tina.
Yes.
How do you recover from that?
I just can't, Sam. So this was a big morning. So while Mueller was doing his thing, Lori was doing her thing. So she had her first city council meeting this morning. I actually caught some of it from a live feed, and she was kicking some butt. So high level, there were a few things.
Were you covering live from City Hall?
I was covering live from City Hall.
Correspondent Tina Martini. Legal Faceoff's very own?
Yes, wow. Legal Faceoff's very own. So she covered a few things this morning. She reorganized parts of the city council as she had wanted to. She had replaced the chair of the finance committee with Alderman Scott Wagaspak, I think is how you say his name. She also created three new committees, so we now have 18. She's got 9 African Americans and 2 Latinos as part of the leadership of these committees. And so I think that the most memorable moment, though, for me in watching this was when she and Alderman Burke went at it. I don't know if you caught it this morning, Rich. So he stood up and he had complained at the beginning before the vote that the rules only use the pronoun he and that they should be gender neutral. She cut him off and he stood up and started complaining about something else. And she said she'll call on him when she wants to hear from him.
Mm.
It was a major smackdown.
Sit down, Burke.
Yep, that's what she did.
So she got the votes, right?
Because she got the votes.
She needed
yes.
26 out of 50, a majority, to put in the committee heads that she wanted to. Many thought she'd get about 30. I'm not sure what the final tally was. But, yeah, I mean, notably during her her speech when she got sworn in last week, she stopped and turned towards the alderman and said, you know, basically, shit's going to change in so many words. And a lot of them were, you know, unhappy with that because they saw it as a signal to, you know, that she was going to challenge their power. I think we all agree that that needed to be done on this show. We've covered extensively a lot of the corruption that's gone on in Chicago City Council with a lot of the aldermen. You mentioned Burke. He was the former head of the finance department. Now it's Wagaspak. But, you know, Burke, you know, is being investigated by the federal government for all of that he's done. He continues to do it. So I think it's a good move. I think there's a lot more that needs to be done to clean up City Hall, but I think it's a good first step. Guys, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it is. And I also think she's going toe-to-toe with Berrios over taxes. And she's the sheriff here. She has made she's stomped her foot down in town and said, hey, boys, guns go down, belts on the side, we're here now. We're here to boogie. And the thing I like is her temperament. She knows what she wants to accomplish, and she thinks she knows how to do it. So now we're going to see if she has 18, 20, 23 things and gets three or four done in the city, that's Herculean in this town. That's massive. I mean, that's a big deal.
John, what do you think her number one priority should be? First 100 days in office, what do you think her mandate should be?
Oh, God, I couldn't even tell you. I
crime,
mean,
right? Crime, is big
you know,
one.
Gun violence in the city, maybe?
Yeah, she came out, you know, very strong in advance of Memorial Day weekend, saying that we need to build, you know, stronger partnerships, not just put more police on the street as, you know, the former mayor did, but I think she's trying to involve much more of the community and some of the leaders in the community to try to, you know, de-escalate the violence we've seen, especially around holidays.
What's a worthy goal?
She comes from law enforcement. You know, she worked on the legal side of law enforcement. She had to look at the good and the bad.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point because she doesn't have a great relationship with law enforcement. She was in charge of
monitoring
the group that monitored law enforcement. Yeah. And one of the main controversies of her first few days in office was she decided to hire not a CPD officer to be
she
her.
She her own private
right,
detail. Had,
right, the yep. guy who was yep. In charge of her before. And that rankled a lot of the police officers because, hey, why should shouldn't you employ us to guard the mayor? That was the
We're
first
your
time
city.
That's been done.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The relationship between her and the police will be one to watch.
Next topic involves another death on Mount Everest. This is the 11th person that has perished in less than 2 weeks trying to scale the mountain.
Yeah, I mean, our job on this show is to cover legal topics. You might wonder why we're covering this story. Well, this individual was the 11th, as you mentioned. He was a lawyer. He was a lawyer in Denver, I believe. He was a patent lawyer, 62 years old. Chris Kulich died while descending. He's the 11th person to die, as you mentioned. It was his dream, his family said, to join the 7th Summit Club, which is scaling the highest peak on each continent. And we've seen a rash of individuals who are dying both in the ascent and in the descent, and especially in what's called the death zone, because there's just too many people. They've given out a record number of licenses this year. I think it was in the 300s or so. And there's just too many damn people. You see these pictures of people waiting to get up there, and there's just so much oxygen at 24,000 feet. And the longer you wait, the less time you're going to have to breathe, especially in this, you know, death zone. So very tragic, you know, by all accounts, although this was something he loved. So maybe not the worst way to go if you're a lawyer and you're doing patent law all day. Maybe not the worst way to go.
Are you trying to say something?
I mean,
about
patent law is exciting, but he died doing something he loved. Maybe not the most terrible thing in the world. Tina,
so
any desire to climb 24,000 feet?
Folger just turned red. I can't wait.
Honestly,
to hear what he's
I think
say.
I'd really rather just work on a patent application.
There you go.
Right now.
Maybe he could have invented a better way to breathe up in the death zone.
Maybe he could have. Yeah.
And patent lawyer patent found lawyer. A way to suck all the air out of a mountain. Who knew?
Yes.
No. But you just mentioned it. You both did. Who thought Everest would be overcrowded? What? Like,
right.
What? We're really challenging ourselves Darwin-wise because we're like, okay, no. Only few people should do that. Now it's like the marathon. Now let everybody
yeah.
run. If you have an overcrowded mountain that's the largest mountain in the world, that's weird.
Yeah. And there's people who are, you know, imminently unqualified to be climbing. It used to be where the people who would – you know, climb Everest or similar mountains would be the, you know, people who are been training their whole lives. Now, because the perception is anyone could do it, you know, people are going up there who barely have trained and who think it's a walk in the park, and this is the result.
Why do they wait until they're in their 60s, too? This is something, you know, 20,
cost.
30, 40.
It's very expensive.
Cost is a big factor, yeah.
60 is the new 30, Sam. Haven't you heard that?
When I'm 60, I'm not climbing a mountain.
Okay, you're 30 now. Why don't you do now?
I'm never gonna do it for the record. But I don't know. I when I'm 60 years old, I will not be climbing a mountain.
I'll just make them out of a molehill. That's my own thing, and I'll be good with that in my backyard.
So we love a good scam on Legal Face Off, and we also love a good psychic. This just happens to be the same topic. We have a psychic scam that was over $1 million, Tina.
Yeah, it was $1.5 million. Unfortunately, a California lawyer was the victim of this scam that went on for
many months. Apparently, she was told by two folks from Las Vegas, your old stomping grounds, Sam, that she needed to pay them some money to clear her chakras and to eliminate her bad karma. Apparently, she took them seriously enough that over time, she paid $1,500 for the chakra clearing, and then over the course of months, they persuaded her to finance a trip for them to go to New Orleans to pay for two BMWs, and she actually handed her credit card over as well. So all in, it was about $1.5 million worth of money that she handed over to these folks. Bad news. I mean, I think, I don't know, I've been to a psychic, but I haven't, handed over $1.5 million.
If only she hired a psychic beforehand to tell her, don't get ripped off by a psychic. That would have been awesome. Guys, are you ever hire a...
We go out when we've had a couple cocktails, Sonia and I do, just because it's fun. Mm-hmm. Because you're like, yay. But I don't know if you know this about your
chakras.
Is
that what you're like?
Yeah.
Yay.
I'm just a bucket of fun. Bundle of energy. Yeah, but it's fun because I don't remember chakras requiring a 3-digit security code. but maybe that's just me and my experience internally.
Well, John, you want to think that lawyers, we have a certain, bullshit detector, that you can't be fooled, you can't be scammed.
Exactly.
That's why I think this story is particularly newsworthy, because, a lawyer is supposed to weed out the stuff, but what was the victim?
No. I see it completely differently. I see this person as somebody, she's a workers' compensation lawyer, as you and I are, probably overworked, and looking for answers. And we're all sometimes thinking that the secret is out there somewhere, and somebody has convinced her that it's these psychics and they've taken her money. But she's really just a victim of somebody who was looking for answers and looking for help. And so no matter how smart you are, when you're in a vulnerable position, you can be taken advantage of.
That's a really good point, because if you're in the soup and you're watching people legally manipulate the system, and you see it so much, and it's flying through at such rapid speed, maybe the simplest thing in front of you is going to seem complex. I don't know. It could be like overload. Like, have you ever seen just a computer just short out, and you're like, oh, I love chakras.
No, but it's like those Nigerian scams or the catfishing. People believe what they want to believe. If somebody tells you they have the answers, you're prone to believe them.
I have attorneys in my office who will get an email from someone purporting to be my managing partner. And these emails are the most, you couldn't even believe, you wouldn't believe that a child wrote them, let alone an actual managing partner. But they're like, hey, I need a favor. Can you send me gift cards? I won't name who in my firm, but people have fallen for it. And I'm like, really?
Words are spelled wrong. Yeah, the sentences don't make sense.
It's completely backwards. Well, here's the thing. Whenever I call my friends, sometimes when they're at work, I'll call and they'll be like, Hank Voigt is on line 3. And I'll be like, hey, how you doing? Is everything okay today? And, Chicago PD is still in the air, And then all of a sudden they'll be like, oh, it's not you. But that recognition is, right, I know it's not you. What happens if you think that's really that person?
Right.
Then your mind's blown, because now you're like, did Hank Voigt from Chicago PD really call me? Am I in trouble? We're going to take you down to the cage. You're not coming out.
It's a pretty good Hank.
Thank you.
Just do the rest of the show as Hank.
Hank Voigt. Okay.
Let's stay in Vegas for this next topic. This one involves Meek Mill, who says the Cosmopolitan Hotel essentially is racist. That's what he's claiming.
Meek Mill,
your favorite rapper.
Sam's favorite Philly-based rapper. Mm-hmm. Is threatening, or may have already filed, a lawsuit against the Cosmo in Vegas because he was, as you said, denied entrance. He was told, and of course it's on video, he video, or his colleague videotaped it, the security is telling him that we have the right to trespass you, which is a Vegas term for basically denying entrance, and he is asking the security why you are not allowing me entrance. I haven't done anything, I've got no history with you. And they're saying, we have the right to deny entrance to anyone for any reason. So the controversy here is, of course, he was asking why, and they're denying him a reason. He's now alleging that there was racism involved, and there's a pattern, he says, not just with the Cosmo, but of Vegas hotels denying entrance to prominent black entertainers. And his attorney was I saw his attorney interview yesterday, and he said, how outrageous he felt this was, because everyone has the right to party. Is there a constitutional right to enter a club? No. I don't remember that in the Constitution. No. So the Cosmo is saying that they had, you know, they have their own reasons. They have the right to deny. They're saying that it was due to overcrowding. Tina, your thoughts?
Well, if what they said is true, that they were concerned about overcrowding, then I'd have to agree with the hotel. But, you know, who knows if that was true? And I, you know, he could very well be right that it is. There are racist overtones or undertones to what's going on. But, I mean, how are we ever going to figure out whether it was really overcrowded or not, right?
Mm-hmm. John?
Well, it's Las Vegas, and you and I have spent a lot of time in Las Vegas, and what sometimes what is not so clear at night looks very different in the daytime. So this to me looks like a misunderstanding, and hopefully that's what it is, because you don't want to believe that a major hotel is, you know, harboring this prejudice and that this rapper has suffered, you know, unfair treatment. But to me, it just sounds like, you know, it's late at night in Las Vegas, and there was some confusion.
Well, they had him on video asking if he could have a meal in the restaurant, and then they still kicked him out. So I don't know if at that point, John, you're already denied at the club, or you then denied from everything else, because he knew what he was doing when he was getting tossed out.
That
right?
Is
and
correct.
He said, "I'd like to have a meal here," and they said, "No, you got to go."
Yeah. So it's Jefferson, I think, said life, liberty, and the ability to party.
Yes.
Party! So you got to get down.
One of the fundamental freedoms that our forefathers fought for.
Right up there near muskets. And
say that five times.
The right to twerk.
They fought for $10 Red Bull cans.
Hey, if I don't have my vodka Red Bull, how can I defend this country? So here's the thing. I always look at the social media that the person who's involved allows out. And if it's edited. And I really pay close attention to who's saying what and why. Like you just mentioned, like, we may never know. I can tell you if it's capacity in there. And if it's not, and they have an actual list of, hey, don't let these guys in, because it's like a good old guy who's like, hey, they're bad news and I don't like them. Then at that point, you now might have a case. The difference is, what if it really was overcrowded? He was going there for his friend's release party because he's a DJ. So if it's really overcrowded in there, I don't want to be in there. So it just, if you find out that they have a history of this, that's the tails in that tape.
Yeah, I mean, listen, from a legal perspective, as we've said a million times on the show, and as John Walker will attest, because it's stapled, it's stitched to a pillow in his living room, you can sue anyone for anything, right? I mean, the question is, how likely would a jury be to award this person damages? Very unlikely. He would have to prove that there was some pattern of racism. We all heard, you know, but the restaurants like Denny's, for example, who got hit with these kind of lawsuits in the past, they would have to successfully prove to a jury that the Cosmo had a history of denying people entrance because of the color of their skin versus some other factor. It's a very, very hard standard to prove.
Well, the other thing really quick is, you see in his video, he's in his car. He's not distressed. If you didn't let me in because I'm white and Irish, which is everywhere, I can't go. You basically would realize, I'm pissed. I'm mad. And he's in his car just like this. And then as he's having a discussion, he keeps cutting them off. And it seems like, I think you just hit it, the nail on the head. It's late night. You can't go in your friend's place and you're like, what's up? I'm a really famous rapper and I should be able to go where I want to go. You're like, I understand that. Can't do that. Now, if that turns out to be the case, that seems what it looks like. Great. If not, and he has a beef, you should follow through.
Mario Batali has pled not guilty in Boston, and the details with any of these stories, obviously, you want to have all the information before you go forward, but the latest is that he has pled not guilty to groping and kissing a woman in Boston.
Yeah, so...
Former owner of Legal Face-Off Christmas Party Italy.
That's right.
He's divested himself from Italy because of all these issues, but...
That's right.
That was our, Christmas 2017,
that's right.
Wow. You left early. You left early, like you always do.
I did. I had to go meet Batali.
I stayed till the bitter end, and it was fun. So anyway, Mr. Batali, I should call him Chef, pled not guilty last
Friday.
You
should call him number 764-374, but go ahead.
So he pled not guilty last week. This incident apparently or allegedly happened in 2017 when he was taking a photograph with this woman who claims that he groped her and kissed her repeatedly without her consent. This is one of a number of allegations and charges that have been lodged against Batali over the past few months. What's interesting is that the press that I saw on this seemed more focused on the fact that he's lost a lot of weight over the last few months rather than on the actual charges themselves. So he apparently was well behaved in court, but people were really talking about the fact that he looks like he's lost a ton of weight. So.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, these kind of cases are being brought more to the forefront in the wake of the Me Too movement that we've covered extensively on our show. But yeah, seems like a pretty compelling case for a pattern of behavior over several years that seems, you know, he seems guilty from what we hear. But we'll see what the court says. Guys, what do you think of this story?
Well, I think, does he still wear Crocs?
That's his biggest,
well, he was crockless, wasn't he? I think he was crockless in court last
week. If he's crockless in court, that's a step in the right direction, and I'm not minimizing anything. Here's the thing. If the whole Me Too movement could end if pride and ignorance ended, and you just said, yes, I did this. It's people worried about the deluge of social media and everything, which that I understand. That's a powerful weapon. But if you just go, yeah, I did. Now, it's a different question. You guys know this because you guys live in this soup as lawyers. Now, how do I separate the valid claims from the invalid claims and who's just looking for money or a payday and who's actually viable? And the people who are looking for a payday are the worst bad actors on the planet because they are damaging people who have legitimate important claims. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I mean, that's all... We've talked about this before, Tina and I, that the defense is always, oh, well, the accuser is looking for her 15 minutes of fame.
Exactly.
But when's the last time an accuser got 15 minutes of fame? I mean, what accuser is coming out and, you know, accusing someone of something that's not true, and then suddenly he's getting a talk show, or suddenly he's becoming a movie star? It's ridiculous.
They get beat down so hard.
Right, it's the opposite is true.
Exactly.
John, you know, this seems to be prevalent, you know, in certain industries, but in the restaurant world, there seems to be a lot of this going on where people in power, like chefs, who are predominantly male, not always, I think the number has grown, but there's a lot of allegations, especially of celebrity chefs who have, you know, been accused of this kind of thing in the past. I don't know if you've got any history working in restaurants or anything, but
I worked in restaurants for years, but all my bosses were women, and I was never in that type of environment. I mean, I guess we a certain amount of caution. Remember that this guy is innocent until proven guilty, and he makes the headlines because he is famous. So when I think there's an automatic assumption of his guilt, and I think that pause is warranted because we don't know what happened, and he is entitled to his day in court, and whether he has behaved or been accused of bad behavior in other circumstances doesn't necessarily make him guilty in this circumstance. But you know, there is a pattern. It is disturbing, and you know, it certainly doesn't reflect well on him.
Where there's smoke, there's chef.
There you go.
Don't know.
Coming up next on American Top 40, Kesha Gugu at number 14.
You're too shy.
Don't you want me, baby?
A little bit of Wang Chung.
I could listen to this
one.
Everybody
for a while.
Wang Chung tonight.
This is outstanding.
And Debbie writes to Jeff, "Dear Jeff, I can't believe we never hooked up at summer camp.
I used to have a dog named Snuggles. If you're out there, Snuggles, this song's for you.
Please, like, thanks."
It's an all Casey edition.
And look at that. We're out of time, and I'm going to shut all your mics off. John Walker from Woodruff, Johnson & Evans, and John Bolger. When can we hear you on WGN?
With Patty. You can hear me on Wednesdays, sometimes Mondays, talking White Sox and talking about Chicago.
All right. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thank you.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab, so hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this, now. Courtroom combat going hand to hand.